Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned. Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving pranams at the lotus feet of God incarnate, Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. Sai Ram, good morning and respectful greetings to all our listeners from Team Radio Sai. Thank you, dear listeners, for your company on Thursday Live. We are coming to you live, as you may have guessed, from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. The time in the ashram right now is 38 minutes past 9 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time. I guess I got ahead of myself and I logged in 2 minutes too soon. This is your very happy and excited host, Karuna, welcoming you to Morning Glory. As I connect with you from heaven on earth, where the spiritual climate is always perfect. But right now, even the weather is more than perfect. As we speak, and for the past 2 days, it's been easy, breezy, and so very happy busy around here, with our weather conditions being truly pleasing. The monsoon has been tracking normally and we are enjoying very pleasant climate in Prashanti Nilayam. Today is the 18th of June 2015 and I'm delighted to bring you an episode of Learning with Love with a guest whose words fall gently on the ears and their honesty touches the heart and lifts the spirit. One of the finest conversations I've had the privilege of hosting is with Dr. Jack Feely of the USA under our new and occasional series, Learning with Love. Learning with Love, as I have explained many times, is a variant of our ever-popular Tryst with Divinity. In Learning with Love, our guests share with us the lessons they have learned at the lotus feet of the Apostle of Highest Love, Bhagwan Baba, and how those lessons have become their mantra for life, transforming them for the better. All this takeaway renders Learning with Love a variant of Tryst, and you could also say it's Tryst with a twist. And here is today's episode with Dr. Jack Feely of the USA. Happy listening and please enjoy. And when on the other side of this interview, I have some very important messages from Bhagwan, and they may just be the antidote you need in this age of doubt and confusion. Please enjoy this interview with Dr. Jack Feely. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Learning with Love. Today we have a very special guest all the way from America, Dr. Jack Feely. Dr. Jack Feely is a psychologist, and for over 30 years he has been in clinical practice in St. Louis, Missouri. He is also an organizational and management consultant who works in and out of St. Louis, Missouri. Jack Feely first heard about Satya Sai Baba at a meditation seminar in 1977 and began reading many books about Swami and studying his discourses. In 1990, Dr. Jack Feely first visited Prashanti Nilayam and was blessed with 2 interviews. He was moved by Swami's intense loving presence and his compassion. He has been to Prashanti Nilayam for 15 times ever since. After that first experience, Dr. Jack Feely became actively involved in the Sai organization, eventually serving as center president, regional president, and national service coordinator. Currently, Dr. Jack Feely is co-chair of the International Disaster Relief Committee of the Sri Satya Sai International Organization, national vice president of the Sai Organization of USA, and coordinator of the Sai Love in Action website project. Sai Ram, Dr. Feely, and a very warm welcome to Learning with Love.
Thank you very much, Karuna, and I want to wish you a happy Ladies' Day.
Thank you so much.
And maybe a happy Ladies' Day to all the ladies who will be listening to this, even though it will be in the future.
Absolutely, because we are recording this on Ladies' Day. Now, Dr. Feely, you have quite a long association with Bhagwan, and you've held so many positions in various branches of the Sai organization. I'm sure, coming from the background that you come, there must be so much learning that must have happened along the way. And I was wondering if I may request you to share some of the lessons you have learned from this incarnation of love.
Sure, I'd be happy to. In fact, you and I talked yesterday, and you asked me to think of some of the lessons in love. And this was a wonderful exercise for me, because it forced me to go back and recall and remember and be aware of the love lessons that I've learned during this journey and some of the things that basically supported that. I'll tell you one of the lessons I learned, and that was looking back in 1977 when I first heard the name Sathya Sai Baba. And the lesson, looking back, it's to be open to God's voice, to His words, even to His whisper, because we may not think we hear it, but we really do hear it. Now, I'll give you an example. I said I first heard about the name Sai Baba during a meditation seminar. I traveled down to Jackson, Mississippi, which is outside of where I live. In fact, that's the home of Dr. William Harvey, because he and I worked together for 10 years in the drug treatment field. We're both psychologists, and I suppose many psychologists keep exploring different ways to live life, because one of the reasons, I think, is because the clients we see, the patients we see, sometimes they seem to do all the right things, but they have problems and they have challenges, and sometimes other people seem to go off the road, and they seem to appear to be happy. And so I wanted to find out what is really going on with human behavior in the mind and life, and so like a lot of psychologists, I explored meditation and a lot of other things. And Dr. Harvey told me about a seminar he took, and I was curious. It was called Alpha Thinking, and actually it was given by a British guy named Alexander Everett. And at that time in the 70s, there was something called the Transcendental Movement in the West. And these are people who realized that there's something more than the logical black and white way of thinking. And there was the beginning of a whole transcendental movement of thinking in the West. So I flew down there, and I didn't realize Dr. William Harvey was also taking his second seminar at the same time. So we spent a weekend. It was really a good experience for me, a full weekend of a certain kind of meditation. But Alexander Everett, the British guy who was giving it, at one point he casually said something. He had just come back from India. And he casually mentioned, he said, the holiest person on the planet lives in southern India. And that struck me, and obviously it struck Dr. Harvey too. I don't know if it struck the other people, because at lunch we went up to Alexander Everett and we said, so who is this holiest person on the planet you mentioned? He said, his name is Sathya Sai Baba. And that was the first time, and I'll always remember the first time I heard Swami's name. Looking back, I think perhaps some other people dismissed that. You know, the seminar teacher mentioned that. But maybe that was one of those experiences that perhaps God wanted me to pay attention and to listen to that word. As a result, we learn more about Sai Baba. Dr. Harvey then, months later, made his first trip to India to see Swami. Back in probably it was early 1978. And he came back and told me stories and experiences he had. He brought me some books. Sam Sanwise's book, Holy Man and the Psychiatrist. And when I read that, I knew this is the truth. And I'm looking back, how did I know that? But I read this book, and it's saying that Sai Baba is divine. And I knew without a doubt. I was that moved.
Really? And what sort of a spiritual background did you grow up in?
I grew up Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. In fact, not just Catholic, but Irish Catholic. My mother came from Ireland, and that's a very Catholic country in the United States. My father was born after his parents came from Ireland, so I've got this Irish background, and it's a pretty strict Catholic background. So I went through, taught by the nuns in grade school, and an all-boy high school, taught by the not priests, but an order of brothers who take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. But they're a teaching order as opposed to an order of priests that work with parishioners. And then for college, I went to a Jesuit university. You know, you'd wonder, my mother wondered, why didn't you become a priest? Because typically in an Irish Catholic family, there's either one son who becomes a priest or one daughter who becomes a nun. But my large family, none of us went in that direction.
I see. And Dr. William Harvey, who you speak of, is of course a member of the Prashanti Council now.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
A very well-respected member of the International Sai Organization.
Yeah, in fact, he and I have worked together, known each other for over 40 years,
wow,
way before either of us had ever heard of Sai Baba.
And you know what's interesting? You mentioned the name of Alexander Everett, and he made such a huge declaration at that seminar that the holiest person on planet lives in South India.
Yeah.
Strangely, I have never come across that name in Sai literature. Did he ever get to meet Baba? Do we know that?
I know he went to Prashanti,
okay,
and I don't know if he had an interview. So I don't know if he actually met him, but he was moved enough to say publicly in the seminar,
that's so interesting.
The holiest person on the planet
lives in South India.
So that lesson of
Being open and listen.
And I'll tell you something else that supports it more to the recent past, and that was in 2010 when I was at Prashanti. And this is during a USA national pilgrimage. And because I was one of the officers, I was involved with the Sai Love in Action website project. I was helping organize that, and I sat up front, and when Swami in his wheelchair would come by. But I wanted his blessing, so I wrote a letter to him asking him to bless the Sai Love in Action project. And he came by and he nodded and I gave him the letter. And the next day I took a letter and I wrote it as a document. And so when he came back, I held out the same letter, the document. And he came by and he nodded and I walked up to him and showed it to him. I was going to hand it to him, but he stopped and he started reading it. And many people know that at that time in 2010, his voice seemed to be so weak that it was very difficult to hear him. And so I was talking to him about things. He was with his finger pointing to different things in the document and saying some things. And I realized there's no voice coming from his mouth. He's moving his mouth. There's no voice. Yet I was answering his questions. This was the most amazing experience. I did not hear his voice. I saw his mouth move, but I was answering his questions. And later I was thinking, how did that happen? What did that mean? What I conclude for me anyway is I don't have to hear the loud voice. I know what he's saying and I know how to respond. So to me, it's always listen, even to God's whisper, even if you don't hear the voice itself, because we know what he's telling us. And he did bless this Sai Love in Action project. In fact, at one point, we were out there for a long time. It was me kneeling next to his wheelchair, and Mr. Chakravarti seemed to told the young adult pushing the wheel to keep on going. So he did, but then Swami pointed to something else in the document, so they had to stop. And I had more time to talk to him, and he pointed one thing about one of the projects, service projects, was a prison project, and he pointed to that. And I knew he wanted me to talk to him a little bit about that, even though I didn't hear the voice. So I talked to him, and then we were finished, and then he went on.
So to listen to God's whispers, you don't need his audible voice.
Yes, we don't.
The soul, I think, comprehends, communicates the best in silence.
Yes. We don't get distracted by all the other noise. So that's a wonderful lesson.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I guess you have to still your mind to be able to hear those promptings. All the distractions of the senses have to sort of come to some sort of level of stillness.
Yeah. You know, one time during an interview, I was asking him something, and he said that, yes, 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 listen to God. Always listen to God. Now, I think maybe as a psychologist with an analytical mind, I think always listen to God, that means 24 hours a day. I could listen to God as long as I'm paying attention. Let me tell you, to share maybe another lesson, a love lesson that I've learned during this journey. And that's that sometimes God decides the timing of everything. You know, we think we're the doers. And sometimes our ego tells us, yes, we can do this, we can do that. And then it looks like we succeed. Sometimes we crash and fall. But we're not the doer. And God is the doer, and he decides the timing on perhaps everything. You know, an example, I talked earlier that as a psychologist, I wanted to explore a lot of different kinds of philosophies and schools of thought and try to understand human behavior and the human mind and why some people are happy, some people are not so happy, why some people appear to succeed, some people appear to not succeed. And I was curious because the lessons I grew up with, if you do good things, you'll be fine and happy and live happily ever after.
It doesn't work like that in real life, does it now?
Not always, does it? No. So at that time, this is probably 1989. And since 1977, I was listening to discourses, reading books. And at that time, after I heard about Sai Baba, I wanted to go to a Sai center. And so there was one center, a small center in St. Louis. Today, there's three large centers in St. Louis. So it's grown quite a bit. So I went to a center. It was in somebody's apartment. And I had an experience there that was, at the time I thought this was not a good experience. Much later I look back and think that was a wonderful experience.
So what exactly happened? Can you elaborate?
Yeah. I went to the center. I didn't know anybody. And the lights were dark and people did not seem friendly to me.
Mm-hmm.
There were some Westerners and some Indian, and there were devotees, and so they told me to sit down, which I did. I got there early, and they started singing Indian bhajans, no English, Indian bhajans, and I didn't know what the words meant, but I stayed there listening to them. And after the budgets, there was no study group. In fact, there was just people kind of whispering to each other, talking. And I thought, nobody's welcoming me. I don't feel good be here. So I left, and I thought, how can this be? Everything I've read about Sai Baba, about Swami, is love and compassion. But this group, I didn't feel welcome. But I decided I'm going to go back the next week. So I went back the next week, and it was similar. There's no welcoming. People didn't really acknowledge me. And there was only a small group, maybe 10 people there. And after the Indian bhajans, which I didn't understand, again, they kind of sat in little groups and talked. So again, I left, and I thought, I'm not going back to the center. It just doesn't feel right, but I love Swami, and I'll continue to read and learn what his messages are. So I think maybe that was a negative experience. But looking back, once I got involved years later with this organization, I am so grateful I had that experience, because now when I go to different centers in the United States, I'm very aware how this might appear to a newcomer.
Exactly.
Who knows nothing about Sai Baba. And I've seen some wonderful, really inviting, loving centers, and some centers that I think can have can improve for especially newcomers, Western or not Western, come in not knowing, a little curious.
They're unfamiliar with their culture there.
Exactly.
And now you're able to empathize with them and see things from their perspective.
Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it was Swami's timing for me to have that experience and have a different experience later.
And you're an office bearer, so you can impact change by ensuring that the way we operate and welcome or receive newcomers
is
more consciously loving
and
inviting.
Yeah. Now, even now when I go to a center, because I've been to Prashanti so many times, and it's not just the culture at Prashanti, but the Indian culture I've loved. I've learned to love and the food and everything. But when I go to a center, I feel comfortable, but I want to see it with another set of eyes. Mm. What if a newcomer comes in? In 1989, so I've not been to a center until for all those years, although I would continue to meet with Dr. William Harvey, and he was going to Prashanti every year. But I wasn't drawn to go, but I was drawn to go to hear him talk about his experience and to read books he would bring back for me. And then during that time, too, I felt like I was going to take a trip someplace, maybe some kind of a trip, an adventure, an exotic trip. And I started making plans, stumbled across a plan to go to Belize with a group of people I didn't know, but it was a sponsored trip. So I started thinking maybe that's where I'm going to go. And at that time, I'd not talked to Dr. Harvey in quite some time. And I was sitting out at an outside cafe in St. Louis, and he walked by, first time in a long time I'd seen him. And we chatted, and he said, listen, by the way, in a couple of months I'm going to India again. And I'm bringing a few people who have never been there. And one of them, she lives in California. I used to work with her. Consider coming. I said, okay, I'll consider it. At that moment, I didn't. But I got these messages. Even a couple of days later, I was thinking, Belize, where it's going to be comfortable and fun, and or India to see Sai Baba. And while I was thinking one time driving, I came across a car with a license plate, SAI. Mm. But it wasn't a devotee, I learned, because I'd see that car every once in a while. It must have been some corporation, SAI. But I thought, why do I keep seeing that word? And then I'd have a dream, and I knew that I was supposed to go. So I went.
So many signs.
So 1990, I went. And one thing about that, because God decides the timing, I'd mentioned that I'd been blessed with two interviews during that time. First week or so we spent at Prashanti, the second week Swami Kate went to Whitefield. And in Whitefield, I was sitting there in Darshan line, and Swami left, and I was just moved, and I was walking kind of in this amazing feeling came over me, and I came to our taxi driver, and I looked at him, I said, I think I just fell in love with Swami. That feeling that maybe when you're young and you meet somebody and you think you fall in love, that was the same feeling.
Your heart was singing a song and you were sort of floating in the air.
I felt this joy and this amazing affection towards this person. I fell in love, and my taxi driver just smiled and nodded.
Crazy Westerner sitting at the back.
Yeah.
Okay, but if I may backtrack, Jack, what was the first interview like, that first experience of coming face to face with him?
Well, that was very curious. This is my first time in India, my first time this distance away from my home in the United States. The small group of us with Dr. Harvey were taking a bus tour from the airport, actually, to a hotel we spent for a night. And I looked at them, and I looked at me, and I realized our mouths were hanging open. we're just amazed at everything, the culture, the sound. So then when we went to Prashanti, and it was hot, hotter than I was used to. I think it was in March.
It's a hot month.
Yeah, very hot. And so the first day I'm there, I got a room, shared it with some other people in one of the round buildings, and I started walking. and I was walking all over the place, the ashram, and walking outside up and down, and I'd run into Dr. Harvey, and he said, "Jack, you're not used to this kind of weather. You gotta stay inside. You gotta get used to it." I said, "Okay." But I kept walking, and I stayed outside, and I ran into him a second time. He said, "Listen, I don't want you to get sick. You're not used to this weather." And I said, "Bill, I feel like I'm on a walking meditation." And he smiled. That afternoon, we were called for an interview. And a couple things happened during that interview. I know nothing about the protocol of the interviewer, but I knew that touching the foot of a holy person is a very, very blessed thing to do. So I sat up next to his chair. And he, you know, sat down, and he's talking to different people. And I noticed a lady on the other side was holding his foot. So I held his foot. And then I was thinking, this is in 1990. He walks without sandals. He walks in the sand because it was sandy at that time. What amazed me was his foot, the bottom of his foot, was as smooth as a baby's skin. And I thought, how could this be? How could this be? I kept touching his feet and rubbing, and I thought, oh, I shouldn't do this, but how can a man at this age, who I just saw walking in from the sand,
barefooted all the time,
all the time,
have cracked heels,
exactly,
but and calluses on his feet.
It was like a baby's skin. Mm. Then, when he looked at me, I told you I had taken this walking meditation, and he looked at me and he said, "How was your walk?" And I thought, how did he know about my walk? Mm. In fact, later I asked Bill Harvey, "Did you tell him about my walk?" He laughed. He said, "No." But he said, "How was your walk?" And later I was thinking, maybe for those 12 years from the time I heard his word till the time I finally came to see him, it was like a walk in the material world, halfway in the material world, halfway in the spiritual world. Well, I'm finished with the walk. So he said, "How was your walk?" And I said, "Swami, it was fine, but I thought, but I'm glad to be here." So that was the first interview, the first experience I had with him. A third lesson in love that I had realized I had, and that's that every word that Swami tells us, whether in person, before he left his body, in a discourse, when we're reading his words, everything he says, every word, is the truth and is sacred. Everything. He doesn't make small talk. He doesn't waste words. It may appear because in the human form, at times he would chat and laugh. An example, my second trip to Prashanti in 1993, and I was blessed enough again to have an interview. But that was an experience because now I was, you know, the first trip I had two interviews, and I thought, oh, that'll be fine. Every time I come here, I'll get a couple of interviews. Well, it doesn't happen that way. But the small group I was with, I would tell them, oh, today's the day. You know, I was real up and positive. Today's the day we're going to have the interview. And we didn't. And the next time, next darshan, oh, this is it, this is it. And we went through that whole time there. And now it was for the last darshan. And I was sitting there waiting for them to come out, the last darshan, because a couple hours from now we're going to leave. And I was thinking a serious thought. I didn't have an interview. Am I glad that I came here, though? And I didn't just say casually, yes. I thought, am I glad I came here? Without the interview, am I grateful? Am I glad I came here? And I thought, yes, I am glad. And then at that moment, I gave up the desire for the interview because we weren't going to have an interview. It's the last darshan. I let go of the desire. I let go of the expectation. But I was left with, I am so glad I came here. Swami came, and my line was called first, and I happened to be sitting up. And he came from the lady's side, and he's walking from the lady's side over to the gent's side, and he looked at me. And the entire time he was walking from the ladies over, and I was midway across from in the gents section, he kept looking at me, staring at me, and he walked straight towards me. And I did have a letter, and some Vibhuti, thinking that he might take a letter if he didn't give me an interview, he might bless the Vibhuti. We had eye contact the entire walk. He took the letter, touched the Vibhuti, and I said, "Interview, Swami?" And he said, "How many?" And I told him, and he said,
magic words, oh, you were waiting for.
Yes, and he said, go. And in that interview, really, again, changed my life entirely. In the interview, and I thought, my first experience was, he seemed to be talking more to people who ask questions, so I'm not going to sit passively. I'm going to ask him things. And a couple things I asked him. I was keeping a journal, and I thought, maybe I'll write about some experiences, but maybe this was ego. I said, "Swami, would you bless my writing?" And he had tapping the top of the head. He said, "Yes, yes, I bless, I bless." Then I said to him, "Swami, sometimes I have doubts, because sometimes, you know, sometimes I do have doubts about him, about everything I think I believe." And I was being troubled at times during that trip. I said, "Swami, please help me. Sometimes I have doubts." And he said, "I will help." That's what he said. "Think of God. Only think of God." And then I felt this joy inside. But then he said something to me that I didn't expect. Now, I wasn't married, never had been married. And he said to me, "Where's your wife?" I didn't expect that question. I said, "Swami, I don't have a wife." He said, "I know, I know. But now you want wife." And I've gone back and forth during that time. I thought, well, In fact, I even wrote him a letter one time, mailed it. I said, Swami, I'm not married. I don't know if I want to be married. There's nobody I wanted but marry. If I'm not going to be married, please help me accept that. So he said, yes, I know, but now you want wife. And then he looked at me and he said, come next time, bring wife. And I thought, oh my goodness. No, first of all, before that, he said, spell wife. And I thought, I got confused, spell wife. And I looked at him confused and he said a second time, spell wife. And I thought, does he want me to spell somebody's name? That sounds like a commitment. And then somebody in the interview room said, Jack, you can spell wife. I thought the word, I said W-I-F-E. He smiled. He said, yes, worries internally forever. I'm still trying to figure that out.
And sometimes he would say, worry invited forever. And then he would, after saying that, Swami would cover up and say, no, actually it's wisdom invited forever.
But then he said, come next time, bring wife. And that was curious because when I left, I thought, what does that mean? And I ran into Dr. Hislop sometime after that at the airport. He was flying to Detroit to give a talk, and I was flying for that same conference. And I'd never met him, but I knew what he looked like. So we got to sit next to each other in the plane. And that was a wonderful experience because he showed me his ring of a Shirdi Sai. So I told him, I said, about the experience. I said, Dr. Hislop, Swami said, come next time, bring wife. Does that mean I cannot go back to see him until I'm married? He says, no. Wife is the one closest to you, and that's God. God is your wife. So I thought, oh. Well, it turned out the next time I went was with somebody who I married. So he did change my mind because Indian ladies, they do not like to see a single man or a single woman. So they did this arrangement for me and a devotee in Milwaukee, which was 400 miles away from St. Louis. And
so you had some sort of an arranged marriage?
Well, it was the ladies wanted us to meet, and I knew Kathy from just a conference, but somebody said, well, you should call her about this manual that she developed there. Maybe we can have it in our center. And I called her, and we started talking about Swami. And then called her again. And we talked every night talking about Swami. It was like having a study group over the telephone. And then one thing led to another, and it reflects the fact that everything Swami tells us is sacred and the truth. And so he said to me, come next time, bring wife. And my first trip to Prashanti was 1990. Her first trip was late in 1989, just a few months apart. She shared with me that she got an interview, and he talked to her, and he said to her, I'll send you a good husband. And he told me, come next time, bring wife. And
so now we know who the real matchmaker was.
Yeah, he was the matchmaker. And there's no doubt about that. And then we realized that, but we didn't want our ego. We didn't want our desire. So by telephone, this is before internet. So we talked a lot on the telephone, and we decided maybe if he wants us to be married, I said, I'd feel good about that. And she said she'd feel good about that. But we can't let our desire take. So we wrote a letter. We were advised, write a letter. So we composed a letter over the telephone, and it was a perfect letter. And we were said in the letter, we said, Swami, is it your will that we start a family? Because if it's not, we will walk away from each other. And we finally finished this perfect letter. And then we arranged to go. And we were going to be very dharmic. You know, she was going to stay in some place, I'm going to stay someplace else. But we flew together. But we decided, this is Christmas time in 1993, and she was a teacher. And so she could only take a short time off. So we had limited times. And the booking agents we used, they said there's nothing at that time, nothing. So she had a friend, a devotee, Chitra, who lived in Morocco. And she and her husband would go to see Swami. And they were just very close to him and always be able to talk. And Chitra said, Kathy, send a copy of the letter because I'm going early in December. I'll give it to him. So it looked like we were going to go because the time, there's no tickets available. And we calculated this later. She did go. She handed Swami this letter from us. And the moment she handed him the letter, we calculated the timing. Kathy got a call from the travel agent who said, you're not going to believe this, but two people just canceled their tickets, and it was the exact time that you wanted your departure and return. Do you want the ticket? We said, yes. So he arranged for that. And so then in this letter, we also included a letter from her mother, who is a devotee, who is the same age as Swami, giving her blessing for us. We also included a picture of her and a picture of me, not in the same photograph, separate, because we didn't want to make the assumption he wanted us, we wanted him. And then we thought, well, if we don't get up close, maybe we'll give somebody else their letter. So we made several copies of the same letter, the same marriage packet. The letter, her mother's letter, picture of her, picture of me, and we sealed it. Then we had several packets. We called it the marriage packet. When we got there, she took a letter, a packet. I took a letter. We went to Darshan. He took hers, and he took mine. And she said, I think this is our sign. I said, we've got several other packets. I'm going to bring a packet for every darshan. Every darshan, he took another packet from me.
Album full of your pictures.
I know it because, in fact, it got to be a game. I said, Kathy, we've run out. Let me find a copier in the village and make copies. He took 12 copies. People were coming up to me saying, I've been here 2 months trying to get him a letter. Nothing. You give him a letter every darshan, but I didn't tell him it's the same letter. But there were times that even I'd be called late, you know, a last line, but I'd walk up and it was like the parting of the waves. It's like people spread and I walk in and I just walk up to the front. At one point, it was pretty far back. He came by and I stood up and he looked at me and nodded. So people let me go and I handed him another packet. So we knew after 12
How
packets.
How many signs did you and Kathy need? 12 affirmations altogether?
Exactly. So we knew, and then so we wanted him to marry us, but... And so we went to his priest and said, priest said, I'll marry you if you want, but I have to ask Swami. We said, but we're going to leave in a couple hours. He said, there's no time for me to ask Swami. So we found a Christian minister who, in front of the Jesus statue in the garden, gave us a spiritual blessing, a marriage blessing, and then we did a ceremony around the Ganesha temple. And we came back and we had a marriage with a Christian minister in the United States. So we consider that an arranged marriage from Swami. So that was a wonderful experience looking back, you know, and... Also, during that time, I think it was the day after Christmas, I had a dream. This is before we had the marriage ceremony. And in the dream, it was a dream of Kathy and me in the airport. She was sitting next to, but the seat behind me, in the airport itself. And Swami came up. And it was funny because he had a piece of toast. And he broke it. And he gave one to her and one to me in my dream. And he said, eat, you're married. And we both grew up Catholic. And the communion bread, the wafer, is very significant.
Yes.
So she said, we have more than enough signs. She said, in fact, Jack, I'm glad you had the dream and not me. So it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. And
look at the sensitivity to your cultural background to give you the piece of bread.
Yeah. So even in the Christian minister gave us a marriage blessing and talked about the bread and at the Last Supper that Jesus broke the bread and gave it to the apostles.
My God. Yeah. And that's the dream you've had.
Yeah.
Masami. Wonderful.
Yeah. May I share another lesson?
Please.
This has to do with service. This is something, you know, for a number of years, I was regional president for over eight years, and then I was national service coordinator for 4 years in the United States. And so I learned a lot about service, and I read a lot about what Swami said about service. And one lesson I realized is that community service, which is wonderful, is not the same as Sai selfless service. There's a big difference. The community service is great. It's wonderful. People have needs, and for us to help people with their needs, but it's not necessarily spiritual. Sai selfless service. And what Swami said, I'll paraphrase one quote, he said, in service, you may change the world, you may not. Basically, it doesn't matter. What does matter is you're transformed, that you drop your ego, you drop your own needs, you drop your comforts, and you're transformed. And that hit me. When we do service, we're the people who are transformed. This is spiritual. This is beyond community service, which I think is still wonderful. But there's no ego, that we are transformed. That's one of the reasons I got involved with the Sai Love in Action website. Dr. Reddy was asking me as a national service coordinator to accumulate stories of selfless service around the 10 regions in the USA because he wanted to condense them and put them in Sanatana Sarthi. And so I worked through the regional presidents and the regional vice presidents, and I got a lot of wonderful stories. And I'd send them to Dr. Harvey. But after a while, and, you know, pretty regularly, every month, every other month, I was soliciting service articles. But they kind of dried up. I did a survey. I realized people were getting discouraged because their article was not being published in the Sanatana Sarthi. And I thought, is that why? And sometimes Dr. Reddy didn't even have control of there'd be a section from the USA or from outside centers outside of India. So I was thinking, well, how can I get beautiful, selfless articles about the service? There's so much service going on around the world. And then I started thinking, it's not just service. I want people to be able to, first of all, focus on, is this helping me transform spiritually? And if so, would they be able to share some of those experiences? And after a while, I wasn't getting articles, so I thought there's got to be another way to do it. And it was in 2009. There was a international Sai medical conference in the United States. In the summer of 2009, I was at Prashanti, we did a regional pilgrimage and put on a cultural program, which was beautiful because we got selected. It was the adults and children of Region 4 mm-hmm. in my region, the young adults of Region 7 out in California. We combined our energies into this cultural program. And one day I was walking up, saw a devotee I knew from the States, Rohan Balasuria, and he works a lot with Dr. Reddy. He was on the cell phone, and I had to talk to him because I was bringing all these bags for the medical conference back, and I was getting different devotees to put 10 bags in their baggage and come back and then ship them to where the conference was. And so I was walking up to him. He was on the phone, and then I heard him say, "Oh, yeah, Jack Feely's here, Dr. Reddy." Then he said, "Okay," and he handed me the phone. He said, "Dr. Reddy wants to talk to you." So Dr. Reddy said, "Jack, are you coming to the medical conference?" I said, "Well, Dr. Reddy, I'm a PhD doctor. I'm not a medical doctor." He said, "Okay, but I want you to come anyway." I said, "Okay, I'll be there." So had that not happened, I wouldn't have gone to that conference. But at the conference, one day, one evening, we were having a dinner at the conference center, and I was talking to people, you know, at the table I was at, didn't know them. I was just sharing this frustration I have about not getting articles. And one devotee from Chicago, who was an IT specialist, he said, "Well, Jack, maybe if I could do a newsletter type format." I said, "Really? Oh, yeah, I can do that." And then this other person, Michael Rakoff, who you've interviewed before, he said, "Well, Jack," I said, "Well, I need editors to help me." He said, "Well, Jack, my wife Susan is a great editor. I'll volunteer her." I said, "Michael, that's great, but I want you to volunteer also." He said, "Well, okay." And so I said, okay, this is the beginning of the Sai Love in Action work. And then when I got back home to St. Louis, there was a devotee who kept calling me every month or so for the past year, Psyche Shore, up in New York. I didn't never met him. He kept calling me and saying, "Sir, Psyche Shore here. I wanted to help. You're the National Service Coordinator. Please give me any service, any service. I want to help." I said, "Sai, okay, if I come across something, I will." And then he called me, you know, a few weeks later. "Sir, Psyche Shore here, just checking to see if there's any work you can give me." Well, when I came back from the medical conference, he called. I said, "Well, Sai, this is timely. I'd like you to join and help me with this marvelous project." And that's where he and I got involved, and he was really a great help. And the whole idea is to come up with articles that include the transformational experiences of Sai's selfless service. First of all, we tried a newsletter, and then we needed a website. And one thing led, and all this was being, I think, divinely ordained, and Swami's fingers and hands were in it totally. Because I didn't realize David Grease and Gene Massey, they had been talking for a long time of having a website. And then we combined, and we got the website. Now, the website today was beautiful, but it's really outdated, and we've got some plans to work with Sai Universe website and combine our efforts. But the idea of the website of the articles that include transformational effects, it seems like so many of us devotees, when we go to see Swami before he left his physical body, we wanted him to talk to us. We'd have questions. "Swami, please bless my son, bless my daughter, find a good wife for my son, and please heal my cousin, or get me this good job." We're all asking him, and we wanted him to talk to us. But now I think we have the opportunity where he talks through us. Not talking to us, but talks through us in our behaviors, in our words. So I think it's time for us to reflect. Am I being transformed? And if so, maybe it's important for me to share this because maybe other people will be touched. So that's all kind of fits into the idea that Sai's selfless service really is different than wonderful community service. It's a spiritual experience. That's when, that was also about the time that he did actually physically bless the Sai Love in Action Project when I handed him that document. Mm-hmm. And I could not hear the voice, the words, but I was answering his questions. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I am aware, even when I'll do a group service project with devotees back at home in St. Louis, I want to remember, this is a spiritual exercise. Am I being moved? Am I being changed? Sure, you know, it's a breakfast service project for homeless people. They're happy, and they can use the food, and it is nutritious. But I have to stop, remember to clean up my ego and say, this is for me. I should be more grateful to them
exactly.
than they are to us.
Yeah, that's where there's a total paradigm shift in the way Sai people are supposed to do their seva. the one who's providing the service is the greatest beneficiary of the act.
Exactly, exactly. It is important for us to remember that and reflect on that.
Instead of focusing on that, you know, I served a nice hot breakfast to 100 homeless people, one has to remind oneself that I nurtured my own soul in having this ability.
Yes. Yes, and I want other people, all other devotees, to remember and reflect. You know, it helps us get rid of the ego, and it helps us become grateful.
Yes.
For the opportunity.
And I think it sort of unleashes some inner happiness.
It is.
Great. And once you have the happiness hormones all activated, you feel so joyful and light and, I think, satisfied with life.
Yeah, so much so, yes.
Like an inner Prozac.
Without the bad side effects of Prozac has.
No side. The side effects are all welcome side effects.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah.
Very interesting lesson, indeed. Yeah. Further down the list.
Sure. Maybe I should share another one. And that's that, you know, as a psychologist, I've become more and more aware of this. And that's that God's presence in our lives is so powerful. And our presence in other people's lives can be so powerful. And it's a huge responsibility, because the presence we have in other people's lives, we have to be careful to have a good experience, not a negative experience. And, you know, as a psychologist, as a clinician, psychologists don't just give advice. I may give advice, but nobody really wants advice. You know, I might give common sense advice. You know, I say, well, you know, you say you're unhappy. It's, you know, I look at you and you don't exercise. You drink too much beer. You do this, you're dead. My advice is stop that stuff. You know, but the thing is, they've gotten that advice from so many other people. They're not going to listen to me. So I don't give advice. What a psychologist does, what the psychotherapy is, it's based on the relationship. Because when I'm working with somebody in my office, what I want to do is be as completely present in that moment as I can possibly be. Because the person has to trust me, but I also have to know that person. And if I'm distracted in my mind, I'm not going to be able to get to know that person. And I have to be safe, completely accepting. I can say, I don't like some of that behavior, but I totally accept you. So the presence that takes place in a relationship in a psychologist's office can be so powerful. To me, it's a little bit like, give me an example that back during an interview, I've reflected back. It was the second trip to Prashanti, and when I got the interview, we're in the large room, and Swami called a group with, you know, next to us back into the small interview room. There were about 15 people, so that was a large group. There were only four of us. We waited in the big room. He stood up, and he held the curtain for the 15 people to pass and go into the second interview room. But I was looking at him, and, you know, we were making eye contact. Swami and me, we kept locked our eye contact as 15 people passed our view between us and went into the small room. Every time they passed, we were still making eye contact. It got to be a game. And after about three or four people, he started to smile and I started to smile. Four or five people passed and we still got this eye contact. Before the 15th person who passed, I thought we were going to laugh because it was like a playing peekaboo with a little baby. Mm. But when the 15th person passed, we looked at each other, he smiled, and then he went into the interview room. That moment and another moment, I realized, my God, Swami knows everything about me. Everything, and I've had my problems in life. I've made poor decisions. I made good decisions, and I did good things. And he knows all of that. That's the experience I had. He knows everything about me. And my God, he still loves me. He still totally accepts me. He's like the divine psychologist. He's like the divine clinician, because therapy is based on the relationship. Mm. What I've realized, Karuna, is all the people I've worked with, if I could kind of hone down what is the one need that we all have, and I'll say it in these words, the need or the desire, I want somebody to get me. I want somebody to understand me, mm-hmm. to really know me and accept me. They don't have to like what I do, but I want to be known by somebody because there's so much loneliness in the world. Even people who live in families, deep inside there might be a lot of loneliness. To be heard, to be accepted.
Accepted, okay.
Yeah, and that's what I felt during that interview. He knows me and he totally accepts me and he loves me despite everything. And that has really influenced my ability to be a psychologist, to be a therapist, because his presence was so powerful to people, and our presence can be so powerful to the people we have contact with, and therefore we have a responsibility to treat everybody as God, as us, just like us.
I find that very interesting, that observation, because if you notice the International Psi Organization, especially the part that's based in America, it's full of people who are professionally in this psi business, whether it's psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry, and who are in the business of interacting with people on an ongoing basis to help them deal with their problems in life. Think of Mrs. Phyllis Crystal, a psychotherapist. Yeah. Dr. Samuel Sandweiss, a psychiatrist.
Yeah, and Dr. Harvey is a psychologist.
Yourself,
yes.
A psychologist. Dr. Phil Goslin is a psychologist. So I'm just wondering, what was Swami hoping or aiming to achieve by having so many people in the area of psychiatry, psychology, psychotherapy, in such key vital positions within the Psi organization?
You know, I'll tell you, one time during an interview with Swami, he said something to me that I know he said to other psychologists, psychiatrists. We were talking and he looked at me and he said, "What do you do?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Swami, I'm a psychologist." And it was funny. He made a face and he put his hands out in front of himself. And one hand he threw out, he said, "Psychologist, you talk to the wife about the husband, you talk to the husband about the wife." And then he looked at me and he said, "You deal with madness." Then his voice softened and he said, "I want you to be a psychologist."
S-A-I-cologist.
Yeah. And I'm still, I guess, learning what a psychologist
is. Why do you think he has so many of you in this business of the psi organization?
I don't know. It's a good question. I've wondered.
And it's more so in America than any other part of the world.
Yeah.
That the key official positions are dominated by people in this line of work.
Yeah. Dr. Levy up in New York.
Dr. L. Levy
and David Kornstweet out in, I think, in the California. Actually, he and I went to the Philippines together, which I'll mention a little bit with the disaster relief work. There are a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists. I don't know why he brought all of us together.
Mostly in the United States of America.
Yeah, but I'm certainly grateful he did.
So what are the lessons has your life with the incarnation of love taught you?
Well, one thing, another lesson that I believe has to do with being happy. You know, Swami would say to people all the time, be happy, be happy.
Happiness is union with God.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons probably the many reasons he brought my wife Kathy and me together was she was the happiest person I've ever known. I've never seen her down, but it wasn't just accidental because she made sure to protect her body and her mind. In fact, let's say if we would, occasionally we'd go to a movie, she'd want me to check to make sure there's no violence, there's no this, no that. She said, you know, I want to keep my mind pure. And even her students, she's taught first grade and then third grade, she brings healthy snacks. She said, I want their bodies to be pure. And she wouldn't watch local news because it's just filled with terrible things. She said, and I used to think, well, maybe that's naive. Maybe she should be more open to the things going on in the world. Later I realized, I'm wrong, she's right. It's wisdom. She guarded what she brought into her mind, into her body, and that's one of the many reasons she was so happy, and she was continually in love with Swami. I was always second place, and that's fine. Swami was the first place. There was some interesting research as a psychologist I came across about happiness, and it was that there's ways to measure happiness, and this is several universities did this study over a long period of time. It came out about a year and a half ago. And what is it that causes some people to be happy? And there's ways to measure happiness. Happier than most other people. And they tried to rule out different possible conditions, but they had these huge samples over a long period of time. The first thing they looked at is it money? And they realized anybody above the poverty line, there's no correlation between wealth and happiness. So they took people who are not in poverty, and there's no correlation between wealth and happiness. There's only two things they found. One is people who are happy seem to be more focused on the present. They plan for the future, they think about the past, but they're much more focused in the present than the majority of people who are less happy. So it's the focus in the present seems to be so an ingredient. The second is that the people who are happier, based on this research, they don't have more good things going for them or less bad things in their lives. It's equal. It's all equal. But they seem more aware of and appreciative of the positive things in their lives. So it's an attitude.
Attitude of gratitude.
Exactly.
For the positive, yeah.
Those are the only two things that the researchers, the psychological researchers found that made, that was different between people who are happier.
So being in the present, not brooding or, you know, dreaming of the future, brooding over the past.
Yeah.
And the other thing, counting your blessings, basically.
Exactly. Tell you, Karuna, I saw this last April. I was in the Philippines. There was a, last November, a year ago, this major disaster. It was the most powerful hurricane on record that hit land. It was about November 9th last year. Hit land, and it was just devastated so much of the Philippines. And I was here at Prashanti at that time because the Disaster Relief Committee, we've been working by email and telephone and WebEx, and so we were finally meeting each other, the group, to continue working on disaster relief guidelines. But 10 days before we got here was this hurricane. They call it a typhoon, Typhoon Yolanda. So we've had to date 6 medical camps, physicians and other clinicians, and there's a 7th that's scheduled. I went in April with about 15 overseas devotees. Most of them were from the UK, and 4 of them were from the United States. There were about 4 or 5 volunteers from Manila. So we did this medical camp, and it was an amazing experience for all of us. We stayed in the Sai home, sleeping on mattresses in the floor, so it was not a luxury experience, but we weren't there for luxury. And every day we'd get up and we'd pack the medications in the truck. We'd pack ourselves and we'd go out 45 minutes and set up a camp. People would be waiting for us. The next day we'd go to another area. Sometimes we'd pack up midday and go to another second area that day. But before we got there, none of us knew what to expect. This is the horrible disaster. Devastation every place. When we got there, even the airport, it was missing ceilings. The airport wasn't functioning for a while and then it was functioning. Buildings were just devastated. Over 1,000 schools were totally devastated. Everybody in that area, we went to Tacloban where the typhoon actually hit ground. So we went to the heart of where the destruction was. Everybody lost loved ones. Big cargo ships were lifted up out of the sea and placed on people's homes. The most amazing thing, we thought we would see people who were just terrified, just broken people. When we set up the medical camps, the people were so happy, so joyful. In fact, when we'd go there, I'd look at some of the people, let's say the mothers, and they still had tears of joy in their eyes because our doctors were holding their babies and checking their eyes and their ears and their mouth and checking their heart. And they were so joyful that we were taking care of the babies. And some of the elderly people had tears in their eyes because the doctors were so compassionately talking to them and checking to see, maybe giving them some medication for certain and doing assessments. Everybody was so happy and joyful. The children amazed me perhaps the most because the children who should be traumatized, they were the happiest children I've ever seen in my entire life, no matter where I traveled. We'd go to a camp and the children would be smiling and they'd practice their English. Good morning, good morning. One lady, we were traveling and she didn't know why we were there, but she still walked up to us and said, thank you for visiting our country. They were so grateful. But then, what really got to me, when I was watching the joy that people we were treating seemed to have and the gratitude, then maybe because I'm a psychologist, I started looking at the other volunteers and I saw tears of joy in their eyes. The joy that I could visibly see that they were experiencing was equal to the joy that the people we treated were experiencing. In fact, 3 of the people were not Sai devotees. 4 of them, actually. One was from the UK. One was Christian, didn't know anything about Sai Baba. 3 of them were Muslims. One a pharmacist, one a doctor, and then his daughter was a pharmacy student. Knew nothing about Sai Baba.
But they were part of the...
They were part of it because they were sponsored by some of the devotees in the UK. But the physician who was Muslim, about 3 or 4 days into our experience there, he was saying Sai Ram to everybody, to each other, to the patients. Yeah. They didn't know it.
Happiness was just contagious, I guess.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Well,
he and I would take a walk every morning before we'd load up the trucks. We just for exercise, we'd walk down to the seashore where where the hurricane came, and we'd see the devastation and small little shops trying to come back. And we would walk in for exercise. And one day we're walking, and I said to him, I said, why did you come here? And he looked at me and said, you know, Jack, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. I don't know why I came here, but I know that I'm so glad I came here.
Wow.
And so that's a lesson. Swami tells us to be happy. And I think we all have the capacity to be happy. Mm-hmm. as long as you realize our happiness cannot be connected to the events in our lives, it has to come from inside. And I think the more we disconnect from the stuff in our lives, the more we give and serve, the more capable we are of that kind of internal happiness.
Very profound and very true. If only we could take this to heart and remind ourselves every day.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes. And we can take it to heart, and we can remind ourselves every day. And maybe that's what Radio Sai is helping people do, because they listen and they're reminded of that, of Swami's words.
That's nice to hear. Thank you for the compliment.
Let me mention something else that I've learned over the journey. And that's how important it is for us to guard against ego in whatever we do. One time, this was back in about 2008, 2009, and as regional president, I was involved with a regional conference and getting a speaker. And we had the speaker who was coming from India. He happened to be in the United States. He was also the orthopedic surgeon who did the surgery on Swami's hip.
Dr. Sundaresh.
And I met him through correspondence from Dr. Bhattachary. Mm-hmm. Dr. Chari is an orthopedic surgeon retired who helped set up the orthopedic surgery department, the hospital, Swami's hospital. Well, about a week before our conference, Dr. Sundaresh was called back to Prashanti for a medical situation. So I didn't argue with that. But now we didn't have a speaker. So I asked Dr. Chari. I said, because I knew he had a lot of experience, I said, Dr. Chari, would you be our speaker? So he said, yes, I'll do it. And he did a good job. He had a lot of wonderful experiences with Swami, and people really thoroughly enjoyed listening to him. And I thought, he's good. He's a good speaker. And I predict people here in the audience from other centers are going to ask him to come speak at their centers, and there's some people from other regions will ask him to speak. So later I told him, I said, listen, I think you did a great job, and I appreciate and I thank you for stepping in. And I also predict that people are going to ask you to come speak at their centers. And sure enough, they did. So about a week, two weeks later from that conference, I was at his house. We had a meeting, and I was sitting in the kitchen. And he looked at me, he said, I have a question, Jack. And he asked me the best question any devotee has ever asked me. He said, you were right when you said that people would ask me to speak, and I'm going to speak. But Jack, how do I stand in front of a group of devotees and talk about my experiences without falling into ego?
That's a billion-dollar question.
It's a billion-dollar question. And I looked at him, I said, it's the best question I've ever had. I don't know the answer. It's much like, Karuna, you asked me to speak, and it'll be recorded. How can I talk about this without slipping into my own ego?
Exactly.
And it's something that I want to continue to ask myself. This one thing that I remember a couple of years ago, I heard Dr. Reddy talk. When Swami asked him to give a talk for the first time, he wondered the same thing. How can I do this without ego? And he even asked Swami. Swami said, Swami gave you love. I want you to share that love with others. Well, my belief is if I stay aware of ego, if I stay aware of it, it's not me, it's ego. At least it doesn't have total control over me. And that's the best I can do. Even walking over here to Radio Sai, to the studio, I was thinking, I am not ego. Ego is something else. I want to stay aware of that so it doesn't grab me when I'm talking. It also reminds me, too, what Bobby said, think of God, always think of God.
Dr. Feely, before you go any further, if I may just backtrack, you know, you were talking about the need to be happy and how your wife, Kathy, she nurtures herself by keeping her mind pure, her body pure and happy so that she doesn't expose herself to things which can weigh us down. But in your profession, you are listening to people, you know, who sit on the couch and then vent. And normally people would be spilling out things which are not pleasant or happy. How do you protect yourself from getting affected or bogged down? Or how do you ensure you don't carry their problems and their sadness and their negativity and allow it to ruin your own happiness? Because sometimes some people are very sensitive. Yeah. And when someone comes to vent to them, they empathize so much with the situation or the difficulty that it almost pulls them down. So how do you nurture and maintain and remain untouched by it and yet try to be empathetic, sympathetic, you know, advise them wisely and not be affected?
Karuna, that is one of the best professional questions anybody's ever asked me. Some people don't do it. You know, in fact, psychiatry is a profession with some of the largest amounts of depression and suicide.
Yes, exactly. So,
yeah. And I'm not immune to it because sometimes it's too much and I carry it with me. And it's something that I continue to be aware of. But even certain things, like if I'm talking to somebody who's gone through, even the words I use, more so for me, if I'm talking to somebody who's going through a very terrible, terrible, painful, horrible situation, mm-hmm. and I'm feeling some things, I'm not going to say something like, I feel terrible that you're going through such a horrible dilemma. What I'll say is, it must be terrible to go through such a horrible. So I want to keep it out of me, but be compassionate, be sensitive, be empathic to understand. I don't want to feel it, because I can be a better therapist if I'm not caught up too much in the feeling, but I have to be aware of it. But being aware of it means I carry some of the feelings with me. So there's this like a professional danger for all of us that we have to continue to guard against. It's important to, as my wife Kathy would do, is I exercise and maintain a healthy body, a healthy mind. I try to read Swami's lessons to remind myself that God's with me. And sometimes I don't talk about spirituality to my patients unless they bring it up, and I'm very cautious. Some people think, oh, you go to India a lot. There must be great golf courses there. Is that why? And I don't tell them I've never played golf, but it's a challenge. It's an ongoing challenge. One of the biggest lessons is love. And maybe this is appropriate because this is Ladies' Day. And love is Swami's message to us. And I mentioned my mother love because he is our divine mother. And an example of my mother, she passed away a number of years ago. She was age 92 and she was 17. She came from Ireland but very physically healthy. And it was back in about 2003. I took her out to a restaurant, and she were coming back, and her leg gave out, and she fell, and she broke her hip. And this is the second time, 2003. And this was a year after I did experience a major loss in my life. Kathy, my wife, died. She died of cancer. And so a year later, this is when I'm taking my mother out, and she broke her hip. And even though she's gone through the surgery and rehab in the other hip a couple of years earlier, she was okay. She did it again. And she was in her late 80s by that time. When she fell, had somebody call the ambulance, and I called my sister, and she met me at the hospital. And she and I were at the hospital. My other sisters later came. We're in the emergency room. My mother, then the doctors did a quick x-ray, said, you broke your other hip. But she went through the surgery, she went through the rehab, and she got bounced back. It was amazing. And then when she passed away at age 92, and that was in 2006, my older sister, Maureen, said to me, she said, Jack, maybe you don't, I forgot to tell you this, I'm sure you don't know this. When we were in the emergency room with Mom, you went to the men's room. You're gone for just a few minutes. And that's when she said to me, you were gone. She said, Maureen, I'm glad I fell and broke my hip. And she said, Mom, what are you saying? Why would you? She's thinking maybe she's delusional. She said, no, I'm glad I broke my hip. She said, I think for the last year, since Kathy died, I think Jack's been kind of lost. This would be a good distraction for him.
Only a mother could have thought of that.
He'll kind of pay attention to me and help me, and it'll get his mind off his loss. And I thought, talk about mother love. She broke her hip and was glad because it would help me. But then, Karuna, I was thinking, when Swami broke his hip, for so many years we had all always prayed to him, Swami, give us this, give us that, pay attention to me. And when he broke his hip and he became ill, so many devotees started praying for him.
Yes. And they forgot their little petty desires and, okay, Swami, just heal yourself.
Yeah. And that, I think, was, like, we shifted from asking him stuff to praying for him.
Yeah.
And to me, my mother, when she said that, to me it was a beautiful sign of mother love and our divine mother. Who knows, when he broke his hip, became ill and frail, we were focused on him, not ourselves so much. So with that note, I'll end that, because that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned in this journey that I'll continue to learn more about it. Love, what love is, how we feel it and how we live it.
Very edifying to hear that from you, from a psychologist. Thank you so much, Dr. Jack Feely.
Thank you for asking me to be here.
For me, this was a very, very enlightening, quick study circle and learning process, just listening to you, and I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm absolutely sure that listeners will benefit greatly from your wisdom and your insights.
Thank you, and Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. You're tuned to Radio Sai's live broadcast on Asia Stream. The conversation you just heard was an episode of Learning with Love, and my guest was Dr. Jack Feely. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We welcome your thoughts, comments and suggestions about this interview with Dr. Jack Feely and all other RadioSci programs by email. As always, you can reach us at listener@radiosci.org. Now, lately, some new words are getting added to the vocabulary of our devotees, causing a lot of confusion. In particular, the word subtle seems to have unsettled a lot of devotees, causing confusion, raising many questions and doubts. Today, dear sisters and brothers, I have for you some very clear, categorical and very strong words from Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba to reflect upon, and I request you to draw your own conclusion after dwelling upon them. Like millions of Sai devotees around the globe, we at Radio Sai remain devoted to Bhagwan's message of universal love and harmony and find all our answers in His divine wisdom. Oh, I hope you will find these words as useful. I have taken them from an article that respected Dr. G. Venkatraman wrote last year. All the quotes that I will be quoting are directly from Bhagwan and they are sourced in that article. But for your listening ease, I may not provide every date, but you can find it in the article by Dr. G. Venkatraman that was first published in our e-journal Heart to Heart in July of 2014. Baba says, and I quote him, "Yet others, invoking the name of Sai and claiming that they have been endowed with miraculous powers by Swami himself, are collecting money. They can be nothing more diabolical than this." Now, dear sisters and brothers, I looked up the word diabolical. It actually means something evil that comes from the devil. So Swami said those who invoke his name and claim they have been endowed with miraculous powers to collect money are actually acting in a manner which is diabolical. I quote Swami further. Swami says, "Sai's name is being invoked and a bad name is being brought to Sai by people engaging in such foul actions. This is one of the ways in which Sai activities are being converted into business transactions." Now, way back in 1962, Baba also said, "There is another set of people who trade on your faith. They advertise that I am talking through a medium or some other things. Treat all such people and their agents and their brokers as you would treat cheats. If you fail to do so, then you also become an accomplice in the cheating process," unquote. In 1965, in Kakinada in coastal Andhra, Baba said, and I quote, "Do not believe if someone comes to you and says, 'Satyasai Baba came to me in my dream and commissioned me to do publicity for him. Please help me as much as possible.' I do not commission anyone for such work, either in dream or while he's awake. Such men are cheats. Treat them as such without mercy," unquote. Now, there's a whole lot of clips I'm going to read you from various divine discourses. The first one from 15th October 99. Baba says, "Our relationship is only heart to heart and love to love, nothing else. Swami is love personified. Swami gives importance to love and nothing else. Do not give any value to mean and meaningless talk. Talking of faith, I must issue a warning. Many people are collecting money in various places using my name for various purposes like arranging receptions, building temples, doing puja, etc. This is unauthorized and against my wish and command. Do not yield to such requests and encourage this practice which I condemn. There is another set of people who trade on your faith. They advertise that I am talking through a medium." Again, Baba says, "Treat all such people as brokers or as cheats." And then he goes on to say, "There are others who gather groups of followers and admirers and collect money. They even declare, 'Baba sent me to you to take money for some purpose. Baba has given me this,' or 'Baba has blessed specifically this and this for you.' And they praise you and they want your purse. I ask you to chastise all these types of men and turn them away, whoever they are. This is from November 25th, 1962, Prashanthi Nilayam Discourse. Now, I have a 1964 discourse. There are some who extol others for the absurd reason that Sai Baba speaks through them. How silly! It is all drama which cheats sick minds. Do not fall a prey to these. That is why I say, keep your devotion within yourself under control and not be led away by crooks and self-seekers. These lead you astray by giving you a wrong idea of the Lord's manifestation. They befoul the faith that their brothers and sisters repose in God. And he says, Baba says, this one I've taken from 1965, March 3. There are quite a few who declare that I am coming upon them, possessing them. Rather, they sway, shake, shiver and say all kinds of things claiming that I am speaking through them or they are under my influence. They answer questions and foretell things and perform many tricks to collect money or things from people who do not know me and my reality. All this is sheer deceit. It is this disease that is spreading. Do not encourage it. Nip it wherever you see it. You see cases of people suffering from it. And then Swami says, some people have agents and brokers. Squash them first and their puppets will disappear. They wear the dress of holiness, but their greed announces them as vile. People say, Baba appeared to me in a dream and commanded me to do this or that to you, to collect so much from you, etc., etc. Do not give heed to such cheats. Punish them in the way they deserve. That is the advice I give you. This is from March 3rd, 1965, Amalapuram. Baba also says, in order to make known my majesty and my glory as the divine that has incarnated, miraculous happenings of an amazing nature do take place in certain areas. Taking advantage of the attraction that these happenings draw upon them, many misuse them for personal propaganda and aggrandizement. There are those who claim that I'm speaking through them and answering questions put to them. These people must be either insane or hysteria affected, or they are possessed by some ghost or by greed to earn money thereby. I can only tell you that it is not I that speaks through them. I'll repeat that line. It's very important. Baba says, I can only tell you that it is not I that speaks through them. I do not need media, nor do I need substitutes or subsidiaries or representatives. This is from the discourse on November 22, 1970, during the All India Conference of Workers of the Sri Satya Sai Seva Organizations held in Prashanti. Then Baba says, this is more recent, 2002. There are some people who are doing business in the name of Sai. They are cheating others, pretending to be devotees of Sai. I do not approve of such behavior. They are not devotees at all. They are going to different parts of the country and also abroad to make money in the name of Sai. This is a big crime. I do not ask for even a single paisa from others. I never approve of such business. Whoever it may be, if somebody approaches you with such a crass motive, tell him to get out at once. Do not allow business to enter the field of spirituality. Baba again goes on to say, in foreign countries, some Indians are claiming themselves to be Swami's devotees and they are telling many lies using the name of Sai for collecting money. Some claim they are constructing schools for Swami and they collect money and temples. They are all blatant lies. Swami has not accepted any money for any purpose. So be careful. Keep these people at a distance who approach you for money in the name of Sai. Baba says, this is from 68, utilize the chance of association with me as much as possible and endeavor as quickly and as best as you can to follow the directions that I have been giving. Obeying my instruction is enough. It will benefit you more than any rigorous asceticism. Practice satya, dharma, shanti and prema, which are dear to me. Resolve to keep those ideals before you ever in all your thoughts, words and deeds. That can confer on you the summum bonum of emergence in the supreme substance of divinity. Now, Swami has given any number of such warnings in the past, but sadly a small minority has always chosen to disregard the red lines, even while professing total loyalty to Bhagwan. That said, the current situation is different because this is the case of calculated misrepresentation with some undesirable consequences. Now, if you think, dear listeners, that everything Swami said was valid only when he was in the body and after the Mahasamadhi, a new set of teachings or rules will come into effect, let us remind ourselves that truth is changeless. Truth is valid for all times. Just as Lord Krishna's words from the Gita continue to guide seekers even today, thousands of years later. Baba didn't put an expiration date on what he said in his discourses and say, okay, this applies till, such and so, 24th of April 2011, and after that there will be a new set of guidelines that will come. That never happened. Next time you have a question or a doubt, the best person to ask is Baba himself. He resides in our hearts and he's ever willing to answer. With that, I now leave you to enjoy some beautiful music after one very important message. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well and Jai Sai Ram, and enjoy the rest of the show. The 90th year of Bhagwan Baba's divine advent is here. What are you planning to offer at his lotus feet? How about a gift wrapped in red? If you wish to partner with the Sai Healthcare to save a precious life, please take the time to donate blood at the Sri Satya Sai Super Specialty Hospital whenever you are visiting Puttaparthi. The blood bank is open Monday through Saturday, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Every single day, patients undergo life-saving procedures here, and a pint of blood can make all the difference. Let's build a favorable blood inventory. If you're a healthy adult, please donate. For more information, please visit psg.sssihms.org.in. Blood, it's in you to give. Please donate. Sai Ram.
Sunshine will come into your life. Rainbow and sunshine will come. laughing clouds and sing the Lord's
praise.
Love for love for Sai Baba
sing. Love for Sai Baba sing.
Giving love and kindness is the way of life.
Giving love and kindness is the way of life.
Open up your heart, Sai Baba
sing.
If you love him.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.